It's Bigler's World, and I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. Let's see here. We got kids' magazines coming out of our ears, I think. Let's see, National Geographic Kids, maybe some Ranger Rick. I don't think I've read that in a couple of weeks. IINS News, Scholastic News for Kids, Boys Life, Sports Illustrated for Kids. Let's start with Kids Post. From the Washington Post. Wow. Quite a few articles in here. Let's start with, how do birds survive cold winters? I don't know how I do. I live in Phoenix. Cardinals, chickadees, and others that don't migrate have a few tricks to keep them warm. Gina Rich wrote this article. Against a backdrop of fluffy white snow, a brilliant red cardinal perches on a tree branch. It's a beautiful sight. But did you ever wonder how feathered friends stay warm and cozy when it's freezing outside? Birds own winter jackets. Yes, they own them. They don't just rent them. Jean Strelka, she's a naturalist at Schlitz Audubon Nature Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She's been studying birds for 30 years. Besides cardinals, other birds that don't migrate during the winter include chickadees, owls, and some woodpeckers and robins. Strelka said that these birds use different strategies to cope with the cold. In fall, birds grow extra feathers, their version of a winter jacket, to prepare for the colder months. When temperatures drop, birds keep warm by shivering. I do that too. She says, just like you jumping up and down when you get cold outside, said Strelka. Some species, such as chickadees and bluebirds, often huddle together to share heat. Have you ever noticed a bird puffing out its feathers on a chilly day? Well, this is another cold weather adaptation. By trapping air in its feathers, the bird creates a toasty layer of warmth around itself. Some birds use a more extreme strategy to survive in a process called torpor. Let's see, birds are actually able to lower their body temperature as much as 50 degrees, Strelka said. A bird's normal body temperature is 105 degrees. Yikes. By bringing body temperature closer to the air temperature, torpor helps birds conserve heat and energy, especially at night. But it's risky because birds can't move during torpor, and they're even more vulnerable to predators. How to help birds thrive. Even with these adaptations, birds can still use our help when it's cold outside. By providing extra shelter in your backyard, you can protect birds from frigid temperatures and predators. A brush pile built of sticks and evergreen branches offers a cozy place to hide. So does an old Christmas tree positioned safely away from the wind. Roost boxes are a special type of birdhouse that you can build or buy. Birds enter these thick-walled boxes through a hole at the bottom and can rest on perches inside. Harsh winters make it challenging for birds to find food. You can ask a grown-up to help you install a feeder or make your own using pine cones, peanut butter, and seeds. That's the feeder. That's the stuff in the feeder. To protect birds from high-speed window collisions, place feeders either within 5 to 10 feet of your home or more than 20 feet away, says Dan Panetti. He's owner of Wild Birds Unlimited in Maquon, Wisconsin. Try to keep your feeders full if you know a storm is coming. Now, this is Strelka talking again. Strelka. Birds can sense it and feed like crazy. They're crazy feeders. If you choose a seed blend for your feeder, look for peanuts, sunflower seeds, or safflower seeds as the main ingredients. These provide nutritious calories, said Panetti. Just like us, birds enjoy a variety of foods, so you might also offer mixed nuts, mealworms, or suet. Suet? That's a real thing. A form of fat that is an excellent source of energy in the cold. Want to create the ultimate haven for wintering birds? Consider installing a heated bird bath. Birds need fresh water to survive for drinking and to keep their feathers in good shape. Not only do clean feathers keep birds warmer, says Panetti, birds can fly better with clean feathers, as do we all. Next article here on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Sticking with Kids Post, everyone says that no two snowflakes are the same, but is it true? An expert on crystals explains how snowflakes are formed and why some snow is good for sledding, but not building snowmen. That just doesn't seem fair. Jason Biddle wrote this article. Most people have heard the saying that no two snowflakes are identical, but with countless snowflakes produced every winter flurry, could such a thing be true? Well, according to Jason Benedict, he's a chemist and crystal expert at the University at Buffalo in New York, the answer is yes. This is because snowflakes are made of tons of water molecules that have become linked to one another, usually forming around a central point of dust or dirt. Scientists call this nucleation. This is Benedict. So there's this teeny tiny microscopic foreign object, and that gives us the water molecules something to hold on to. The shape these ice crystals take as they form is the result of many factors, including temperature, humidity, and air pressure, all of which are constantly shifting and changing as the winds blow. This makes the likelihood that each water molecule in that snowflake would sit exactly in the same place as each water molecule in another snowflake extremely unlikely. It just won't happen, Benedict said. So does a snowflake's structure have anything to do with whether it will be good for making snowballs as opposed to sled riding? Well, sort of. In fact, temperature is the main decider of what kind of outdoor fun you'll be having on snow day. Benedict said light and fluffy snow, which is great for skiing, snowboarding, and sledding, is usually the product of very cold temperatures because all the water molecules have frozen solid. Warmer temperatures produce snow that still has plenty of liquid molecules, creating a sticky and wet winter wonderland for building snowballs, snowmen, and snow forts. You can do an experiment with another common crystal to see how this works. With your parents' permission, stand over a sink and see if you can pack a handful of sugar into a solid snowball. It doesn't work, right? Well, now add just a few drops of water and knead it together, says Benedict. What you see is the sugar starts to stick together. The liquid water is acting almost like glue. If you think that's fun, you should consider entering Benedict's annual U.S. Crystal Growing Competition. Yes, there's even a website for that. Just type in U.S. Crystal Growing Competition, where thousands of students from across the country compete to see who can grow the largest and highest quality crystals. That's starting to sound a little sinister. Entries are typically accepted beginning in late summer. Crystals are a huge part of our daily lives. Not only are they the basis for things such as snow, sugar, and salt, but Benedict said crystals are important components of computers, solar panels, and medicine. So the next time tiny crystals start falling from the sky, take a moment to appreciate where they came from. Perhaps you'll be inspired to create crystals of your own. Next article here on Bigler's World. Sticking with Kids Post once again. They got a bunch of good articles in here. Elephant seal is born far from home, becomes South African celebrity. That's all it takes. An elephant seal that researchers named Zelda gave birth last fall to Ziggy on a beach in South Africa. Elephant seals are typically found on islands near Antarctica, more than 1,000 miles away. When his mother left, researchers protected the pup from predators and then helped him begin his journey south. Heather Junga wrote this article. Ziggy the elephant seal is a celebrity in South Africa, and not just because the pup's local birth last fall, although that was unusual for a creature typically found in the southern oceans or on islands near Antarctica. Okay, who is this? Marine scientist Greg Hoffmeyer. He said, every few years, a few elite seals come ashore on the South African coast, but most of these young animals are in an exploratory phase of their life. To have a pup born here is extremely rare. Hoffmeyer is a researcher at Bay World, a tourist destination in the city of Port Elizabeth. He got involved in October after the female seal that was given the name Zelda appeared on the beach at Cape Recife. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. R-E-C-I-F-E. At Recife. And gave birth to Ziggy. For the next 3 weeks, he and a group of volunteers monitored the pair from a distance and tried to make sure they weren't disturbed by people, dogs, or other animals. When Zelda returned to the ocean in mid-November, the pup was fat and healthy, but still at risk on the beach. That's when Bayworld became Ziggy's temporary home, and he became the team's sweetheart. He loved to play with the dead fish, yes, and don't we all, added to his pool each day for mealtime. Although he wasn't in a public space, visitors frequently asked about him. Just a few days before Christmas, a new adventure began. The research team secured a satellite link tag atop the young seal's head that would allow him to be tracked in the ocean. They loaded him carefully onto a boat and released him about 40 miles off the coast, betting he would head toward ever deeper waters. His journey could provide important new detail on his species. Researchers hope to gauge whether elephant seals rely on instinct to find their way or learn where to go by experience. Or maybe it's both, Hoffmeyer said.
We're able to follow Ziggy's movements on diving behavior at sea.
When the scientists released him, they expected him to swim more than 1,000 challenging miles.
We hope that he doesn't meet any killer whales, Hoffmeyer said.
If he proves a smart, lucky seal, he will reach one of those islands near Antarctica in a few months. The research team wants to follow him for a full year.
Ziggy could teach us more about how pups adapt to the sea and navigate for the first time, Hoffmeyer said.
As of Sunday, Ziggy's adventure had taken him more than 1,200 miles from Port Elizabeth. On January 6th, he entered the Roaring Forties, a stormy region of the Southern Ocean that is home to his species. Braving the region for the past 2 weeks, he reached the Antarctic polar front and is swimming southwest. Ziggy is still fairly far from any sub-Antarctic island, the natural homes of the elephant seals. The nearest is Bouvet Island, which is about 500 miles to his southwest. It's not just the researchers who are keeping a close eye on him. No, no, no. Bayworld, that's all one word. Bayworld is updating the public on Port Elizabeth Museum Marine Animals Facebook page. After a recent journey update, 67 readers had shared the post and 22 commented.
Say, well done, Ziggy, wrote one fan. Keep going till you're getting there, urged another.
It looks like everyone is rooting for a successful journey for the brave seal. Next article here. Sticking once again with Kids Post. Jason Reynolds named National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Author of Look Both Ways and Ghost urges kids to tell their own stories. Author Jason Reynolds has been named the 7th National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, an award given by the Library of Congress, the Children's Book Council, and Every Child a Reader. Christina Barron wrote this article. Jason Reynolds wants kids to love his stories, but he wants them to love their own stories more. The award-winning author, whom the Library of Congress announced Monday will be the 7th Annual Ambassador for Young People's Literature, plans to use his 2-year appointment to listen as kids and teens, especially those in small towns, share those stories. Reynolds, a Washington area native and author of 13 books, including Ghost, Long Way Down, Look Both Ways, A Tale Told in 10 Blocks, said he's excited about taking the role in a new direction.
Well, what I don't want to do is be another mouthpiece that says kids need to read. I realize that literacy is important. I don't think telling them that works.
Reynolds prefers promoting reading and writing by encouraging kids to talk. At school visits, he lets them ask questions, whatever they want.
There's always a knucklehead who asks about what car I drive, he says.
That's okay. All of their questions are valid. Reynolds, 36, credits his mother with instilling in him and his siblings that even as children, their voices were important.
My mother allowed us to talk back. That's what I really wanted to say. She validated my humanity. You're allowed to say that you don't agree.
Although not much of a reader as a child, Reynolds liked words.
He discovered the poetry of rap music and began writing his own poems at age 9. He shared his efforts with family and by 16 was participating in open mic nights around Washington. A lot of kids and teens today, he said, aren't encouraged to do what he did. Essentially, grab the mic and tell your story. That's the name of his platform as ambassador.
I believe that young people, because they're not told that they have the space to speak up, I think they get a little resentful, Reynolds said. I think that what they're all looking for is respect.
This is especially true, he said, of kids and teens from small towns, places with no literary scene, or often even visits from authors like himself.
I've been through there. I've been all over this country. They are always surprised that I'm there, Reynolds said. They say, why did you come here? And I say, why wouldn't I come here?
Kids from small towns will have the opportunity to talk to Reynolds, asking him questions and relating their own experiences. With the help of the nonprofit organization StoryCorps, an oral history project started in 2003, these stories will be recorded and added to the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Reynolds is working out the details of which towns he will visit over the next 2 years. He'll wear his medal, as have previous ambassadors, including John Syska, Katie DeMilio, and more recently, Jacqueline Woodson. But Reynolds plans to deputize hundreds of young storytellers.
I want to put the ambassador medal around their necks.
Next article. I think I got one more, maybe two more. This might be it. The Sesame Street article here. Sesame Street aims to help kids deal with trauma of Syrian civil war. A new show in Arabic will feature Elmo, Grover, and a Muppet who have to leave his home. The new Welcome Sesame TV show will feature familiar faces such as Grover, but also new characters such as Basma, Mazuna, Jad, and Rami Delshad. The show, which will be in Arabic, is for hundreds of thousands of children in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon who have had to leave home because of the war in Syria. This article was put together by the Associated Press. Sorry, I meant to say press. And let's see here. Sesame Street is trying to help children suffering as a result of the civil war in Syria. Sesame Workshop, the nonprofit behind the Sesame Street TV show, has teamed up with the International Rescue Committee to launch a new Arabic TV program for the hundreds of thousands of children in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon who have had to leave their homes because of the war. And let's see, Sherry Weston of Sesame Workshop says,
"The thing that became very apparent in our work on the ground is how critical the need was for children of this region and children who have been affected by traumatic events to have the social and emotional skills they need."
Called Alan Sim Sim, which means Welcome Sesame in Arabic, the show will feature Elmo, Cookie Monster, and Grover, as well as new Muppets, a boy monster Jad, who had to leave his home, and Basma, who befriends the young stranger. A goat named Mazuza adds comic relief. Each show will explore emotions triggered by leaving home and will offer coping skills for anger, frustration, nervousness, and loneliness. In one episode, Basma shares her toys with Jad since he left his behind. Some of these strategies include belly breathing and expression through art. But it won't be all serious. No. According to Khaled Haddad, he's an executive producer, he says,
"The humor has to be there always, which is the Sesame spirit," he said.
Alan Sim Sim will premiere February 2nd on a regional satellite network, YouTube, and national broadcasters in the area. Targeted for children ages 3 to 8, the show will steer clear of political, social, or religious issues, says Weston.
"To the best of our ability, we are not making political statements."
Scott Cameron, he's the executive producer of the new show, says,
"The spirit behind Sesame Street has always been, it doesn't matter if you have purple fur or yellow fur. It's a place where children can feel safe and supported and where real things are tackled, like fear of the dark, frustration, or loneliness. We try to always do it with comedy alongside the heartfelt.
Since fighting in Syria broke out in 2011, some 5 million children have had to leave their homes, according to the United Nations-backed Commission on Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic. Its report this month said the youngsters have been robbed of their childhood.
Okay, let us move to another publication here on Bigler's World. Let's do a little science news. Science news for students.
A first, kids advise hospital researchers on their medical studies. Realizing it was missing key voices, the Mayo Clinic set up a kids-only advisory board. Sheila Mulrooney Eldred wrote this article. Paul Corcoran, yes, I said Corcoran and I meant it. He paces in a conference room as he presents a slideshow. It showcases his latest research on depression. A psychiatrist, he works at the Mayo Clinic, a hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, and he's excited. It is the first time he's described his research to the hospital's newest advisory board. He really wants the board's opinions and feedback so he can improve his study. The board members pay close attention and offer great ideas. After all, that's their job. But they look a little different from most hospital board members. All are children and teens. They make up the only medical pediatric advisory board in the United States. The Mayo Clinic formed this group after it realized that hospitals could be missing important ways to help children's social, emotional, and physical health. Scientists don't often ask kids what they need from research, even though there is a lot of medical research that can affect them. Tara Felder, she's 17. I think it's her. Yes, her. She signed up as soon as her parents told her about the Mayo Clinic's new advisory board. She recalls, "I was like, I can pass 2 hours helping the community instead of sitting around the house. Yes, please." She notes that she dragged her brother along as well. Isaiah Alexander, 15, also is glad that doctors are listening to youth. "I think doctors haven't been teenagers in a very long time, so maybe their outlook on something isn't accurate," he says. "Maybe they'll think it's the same as when you were young and use a biased opinion on forming a hypothesis on something." The aha moment. Another doctor at the Mayo Clinic, Christy Patton, came up with the idea for this board after a meeting of the Mayo Clinic's Adult Advisory Board. Most hospitals have adult advisory boards to help doctors and researchers make good decisions. That day, some researchers had presented information about their work on physical activity among underserved youth in Minneapolis. Patton talked to the program manager after.
"The adults gave great feedback, but it made us think about involving youth," she says. "There was more research coming to our board focusing on kids, so it struck us that we needed the perspectives of youth."
Many doctors and researchers at the Mayo Clinic want feedback on pediatric research, so it made sense to talk directly to kids. The community engagement team at the Mayo Clinic agreed. The group works to make connections with people who live near the hospital. Patton couldn't find any other U.S. hospitals that had a board made up of kids. Once the Mayo Clinic got an official okay to start one, organizers started looking for kids who wanted to serve on the board. They found about 20 kids between the ages of 11 and 17. All agreed to attend meetings for 4 times a year. They convened for the first time last April to meet and start their training. To be on a board for a hospital, you need to know a few things about how studies of medical treatments work. Those studies are called clinical trials. At the first meeting, the kids learned about how people who participate in clinical trials are protected. Doctors and researchers need to make sure that participants really want to be in a trial before they sign up. It wasn't always that way. During World War II, for example, Nazis conducted experiments on prisoners without their consent. And in the United States, scientists failed to give the 600 black men who agreed to be in the Tuskegee study all the facts or appropriate treatment for their disease. That study was ended in 1972 when a government panel found it to be unethical.
By then, it had been underway for more than 40 years. Summer session. At their next meeting in July, the board members got their first chance to give feedback to researchers when they met with Corcoran. The kids also offered some important feedback about meetings. The snacks should be good. That evening, dressed in the navy blue suit and purple striped tie that he'd worn to work, Corcoran clicked through his slideshow. He's trying to help the kids and teens with depression. The medication currently used for this disease doesn't work in a lot of patients. He explained, so he's testing a new treatment. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Scientists think it works because it activates regions of the brain that affect mood. In TMS therapy, a doctor places an electromagnetic coil on a patient's head, like a hat. Hooked up to a machine, the coil pulses. It feels like a light tapping on your skull, Corcoran explained to the board. The machine can make fast or slow pulses, and this doctor is trying to see if one works better than the other. But he has a problem. He needs more kids to participate. He asked the board for help.
And what do you think? How can we get the word out?
The kids had some questions of their own first. Is depression cured after you do it once, or do you have to keep doing it? Isaiah asked. Another boy wanted to know how much it costs. Later, Corcoran said that those questions are important because it helps him understand the types of questions adolescents have about TMS. Then Corcoran passed around a flyer he'd made to advertise the study.
What does everyone think of the flyer?
He asked. The kids had lots of ideas. First of all, the wording should be directed at kids, not adults, they said. A kid with depression might be more likely to respond if he or she saw a poster rather than being told about it by a parent, said Isaiah.
You don't really have to dumb it down, just that teens aren't going to want to sit down and read all these medical terms.
Tara agreed.
Make it as simple as you can, like the way you explained it to us.
And Corcoran asked,
Does the picture of the brain freak you out?
The general consensus was no, but no one was too sure that it's helpful either. Asked if there was a better way to reach kids directly.
Try social media, Tiara said.
Corcoran was eager to know which apps to use. The kid's answer was Instagram and Snapchat. Of course, Tiara noted, most kids might not follow Mayo's Instagram, so the kids also suggested flyers at the library or in the office of the school social worker. Afterward, Corcoran called the kids' opinions invaluable. Other researchers are eager to meet with the kids, too. It's an important reality check for researchers, says Miguel Valdez Soto. He's an organizer of the board. If a scientist can find out that kids aren't interested in a certain topic, for example, it can save that researcher a lot of time and money. In fact, the organizers say that so many researchers have requested to meet with the board that they may have to add more meetings. Good for researchers and kids. The board met again in October when a researcher asked for suggestions on how to make doctor appointments less intimidating for kids. The Mayo Clinic is hoping that other hospitals will follow its model and create their own kids' boards. Pediatrician Young Jung, he leads the board with help of Patton, Valdez Soto, and others. Jung says,
Over time, once we see the impacts, we see if it's worth spreading this to other sites.
After a year, their team will evaluate how successful the program has been by asking the researchers if and how they used the board's suggestions. But they already know the program has been successful in another way, June says. The kids have learned the process and ethics of running scientific research, says Isaiah.
It's a cool opportunity, and maybe it'll open more doors for me in the future.